Welcome. This is Sleeping Through Class. This is Brendan Oroho, your host for today's show, and I'm joined by Kevin Gatto and Nicholas Rishkevitz. Today we're doing part two of our American History episode on the American Revolution. In our last episode, we discussed some of the causes that led to frustration in the colonies and how it would eventually lead to the American Revolution. In today's episode, we're going to be discussing the actual violence in the American Revolution and how the conflict between the colonies and Great Britain escalated. I often like to show my students videos that I saw when I was young. One of my favorites is Schoolhouse Rock's Shot Heard Round the World. This video depicts the beginning of the American Revolution. So, Kevin, can you tell us a little bit about the Shot Heard Round the World?
Yeah, so the Shot Heard Round the World, you know, a lot of people think July 4th, 1776 is the, you know, Declaration of Independence, start of American independence, but really, you got to go back a little over a year, about 15 months prior. In April of 1775, British troops in Boston left their barracks. They're trying to find weapons as well as Patriot soldiers that are going to try and fight against them, essentially to try and crush this rebellion before it even starts. So as they leave Boston, Paul Revere, his famous midnight ride where the British are coming, he starts riding out towards Lexington and Concord and all throughout, and the message spreads through Massachusetts that the British have left, they're coming after the guns and the people. So now that they're alerted, in the morning in Lexington, 77 militiamen are standing off against 400 British troops who march in. They aren't even necessarily trying to fight or stop the British, they just want to show that they're resisting this movement of British troops coming in to do this. But as often happens in these situations, one thing leads to another, a shot rings out, no one knows which side fires, both sides start opening up on the other one. The militia hardly does anything to the British redcoats, who are just firing round after round after round. You know, you're talking about these people who, you know, they're farmers, they work the printing press, you know, they run a shop, going up against an army that just came off the 7 Years' War. They fought on five different continents in the last 15 years. So they're firing four rounds a minute at these troops who are maybe getting off one round a minute. It's a lot to take in. The militia breaks, and the British troops move on towards Concord. And that is essentially what the Shot Heard Round the World is. It's the start of this revolution.
So these Minutemen, these soldiers who are ready at a minute's notice, they were just regular guys showing up to try to stop the British Army, which was, you know, the most well-trained army in the world and one of the most successful armies in the world. So why were they trying to get to Lexington and trying to get to Concord? And what eventually happened?
Well, they were trying to get to Lexington and ultimately Concord because they had gotten word that these patriots that were kind of trying to start this revolution or kind of spreading anti-British information, there was word that they were storing weapons. And obviously the British did not want these people who are very opposed to them, these patriots as we call them, having these weapons, because that would be a threat to them. You know, it would escalate into a conflict, and they wanted to, as Kevin said, basically put an end to it before it really got started. So they were launching this raid to go and confiscate and maybe destroy these weapons, arrest some of the leaders that were sort of pushing this whole movement for independence, and that was their plan to end it. Lexington just happened to be along the way to Concord, but the British do move through Lexington, as Kevin said, pretty easily. But when they get to Concord, knowing that Paul Revere has kind of ridden ahead and warned everybody, they get there to find that the weapons they are expecting are not there. The colonists in Concord had gotten word that the Redcoats were coming. They were able to hide a lot of the weapons and munitions so that the British could not find them. The little bit that the British did find, they end up burning, but the vast majority they didn't find. While the British are looking all through Concord for all these weapons and leaders and all of that kind of stuff that are now in hiding, in the area around Concord, news is spread that the British have launched this raid, and more Minutemen, militia, just regular old people who were trying to stand up to the British, would get together. So while the British are looking for these weapons in Concord, the word is getting out of what they're doing. They're launching this raid, and more Patriot militia, just these regular people, are getting word, but they're coming with their guns, and they're surrounding the British to the point where they outnumber them. As they arrive, and they're sort of surrounding the British in Concord, they notice that the buildings in Concord in a certain area were starting to catch on fire, and they thought the British were burning the town to the ground. What was really happening is the British were trying to destroy the weapons that they did find, and the fire accidentally got out of control and spread to some nearby buildings. But this led to the Patriot militia basically launching an attack against the British. So they're able to use their numbers, which they had now gathered probably thousands of militiamen. They were able to use their superior numbers to push the British back out of Concord. And as the British returned to Boston, it was a long miles-long march, you know, I think it was maybe 15 or 16 miles, all the way along this road on the way back to Boston. As the British are marching, they're getting shot at by the Patriot militia, who are using guerrilla warfare tactics. They're firing a shot or two and then running back into hiding and attacking them along the way. At the end of the day, the British suffer some pretty heavy casualties. They lose 73 killed, they lose 174 wounded, and there's 53 missing, which was far more than the Patriots suffered throughout the day. This would be kind of a key thing. Throughout the war, the Patriots would use guerrilla warfare, hit-and-run tactics, because they couldn't really face off against the well-trained British troops head-to-head. But they could use this guerrilla warfare to their advantage.
Yeah, and it's pretty similar, and it sort of reminds me of how Benedict Arnold and Ethan Allen were able to eventually take Fort Ticonderoga in upstate New York. You know, having those guys that have been trained to work out in the woods and to not, you know, line up and attack in a predictable way sort of helps to surprise the British, and it's tactics they're not used to seeing. Because during this time period, it's usually, you know, a big army against another big army, and they march at each other and just shoot. And it kind of, one of the things that I always tell my students is that part of the reason why the soldiers stood so close to each other is because guns weren't super accurate back then. So if you were firing a gun from, you know, 100 yards away, it might swerve to the left, it might swerve to the right. But if both sides were lined up in this traditional format, there was a pretty reasonable chance that you would hit a target. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the comparisons I like to give my students too, I know a lot of my students are interested in sports and stuff like that, is why are they using this guerrilla warfare? Because they're playing to their strengths, right? It's the same as, I always like to use boxing as an analogy. Say you're going up against a really heavy punching, kind of slow moving, but he's got a lot of power, heavyweight. You're not going to stand in the center of the boxing ring and just trade punches, because he's going to knock you out every time. But maybe you can use some speed. Maybe you can tire him out by moving. Maybe you can, you know, kind of use your speed and agility to get around him, get a couple punches, and then get away before he can return with a really powerful punch. That always seems to kind of make a lot of sense to my students, that's kind of what they're doing. It's just on a grand scale.
So America is in this strange situation where they've started to fight with the British. They've actually had violent confrontations where people on both sides have been killed. But there's no declaration of war. There's no declaration of independence. America's not exactly sure what they're going to do. And the colonies aren't really united. And during this time period, there is a foreigner, an Englishman, actually, who lives in the United States, or there's an Englishman who lives in the colonies by the name of Thomas Paine, who pens a pamphlet called Common Sense. And this pamphlet basically goes viral and spreads all around the colonies. Can you tell me a little bit about Common Sense and why it was so popular?
Yeah, so Common Sense, the reason it was so successful and the reason it was so popular actually was because a lot of the ideas of the Revolution, these ideas were being kind of expressed in the written form initially through people like, you know, John Adams and lawyers, people who were very well educated. But the vast majority of Americans were not super well educated. That being said, a lot of them did read. It's like kind of a tradition going back to the point when they were, you know, kind of their Puritan past, where they were reading the Bible. So one of the ways that he was able to convince a lot of people in common sense was, first off, by kind of putting it into a little bit simpler terms that people could understand, and then also putting the ideas of the revolution into terms people were familiar with. So he makes a lot of comparisons, if you look at common sense, to the Bible. He uses words like Pharaoh to refer to the king, a word that people would have been familiar with if they had read the Bible, and a lot of them had. This has a huge impact because people are able to kind of get these ideas. Ideas like, just because your father was a good king doesn't mean that the son is going to be a good king. Stuff like that. It ends up having a huge impact, convincing a lot of Americans that the revolution is right and that they should join the patriot cause. Prior to Common Sense, it was estimated that about a third of Americans supported the revolution, about a third supported the British and staying with the British. We call them loyalists or Tories. And then about a third were undecided, and he really needed to get that third that was undecided to join the patriot cause. If they did not have the support of them, it would not be successful.
Thomas Paine's Common Sense helps encourage the colonies to eventually officially declare their independence from Great Britain. Nick, can you tell us a little bit about what the Declaration of Independence does?
Sure. So first, Thomas Paine writes the pamphlet Common Sense. It starts to turn a lot of Americans towards the idea of revolution, but they still reached out one more time to the British king through something called the Olive Branch Petition, in which they asked the king to address their grievances and hope to come to a peaceful solution before it erupted into a full war. The problem was, the king had also received a confiscated letter from Patriot leaders talking about how they felt revolution was inevitable. I believe it was John Adams who wrote that. And he declines the Olive Branch Petition. So their last attempt to prevent war has now failed, and America decides it's time to declare officially independence. And I like to say to my students, this is like the breakup letter. The colonists are breaking up with the British. They are writing to them about why this is happening, and they are saying, we now see ourselves as an independent country. That would be written by Thomas Jefferson and approved in July 1776. We celebrate Independence Day on July 4th, July 4th, 1776. And basically, Jefferson writes this document. He uses ideas from Enlightenment thinkers, people like John Locke, who believed in the three natural rights, the idea that, Montesquieu, his separation of powers, that the powers of government should not be concentrated with one person or a small group. The idea of the social contract that Jean-Jacques Rousseau developed. All of these ideas are kind of influential in Jefferson's writing of the Declaration of Independence. It is approved, it is issued to the British, and it basically says, we now see ourselves as an independent country. Now, the problem with that is they are not yet totally independent, because the British are not just going to say, okay, we're going to let you be, you're your own country now. The British are going to try to hang on to it, and that's where we're going to get this Revolutionary War.
So Kevin, what was the response to these kind of early defeats by the British, and then the Declaration of Independence, where the Americans sent King George III a letter that said, we're breaking up and we're never, ever getting back together?
Nice Taylor Swift reference. So the British obviously are not going to be too happy. King George III, he's a monarch. He wants to have direct rule over the colonies. And obviously seeing them declare independence, that's a big blow to him. So he's going to respond in force. He's going to send thousands and thousands of troops to the New World, to the colonies. And they're going to land in Long Island and in modern-day New York City. This is going to be the largest amphibious assault of the war, and really in the Western Hemisphere, too. They fight Washington's forces. They take the troops that, they are not that skilled necessarily. They're not as experienced in combat. So they send a diversionary force to Washington's front and then send a massive force on what's called the flank. So you have these lines of troops. The flanks are the ends. So when you're in a line, you're shooting directly in front of you or maybe at a slight angle, but you're exposed behind you and to your sides. So flanking means they're coming up on the side of you where they can unload all their force right into you and you can't respond to them. So that's what the British do. Send one force up, flank around, and crush Washington's troops. They do this repeatedly going up sort of modern-day Manhattan. They pin Washington in, lay siege to him. A fog sets in, and Washington is able to actually sail across the East River and avoid being captured there. So it looked really bad for the Americans, actually, right on the outset, and it looked like as soon as the proper British military set foot on the soil of New York, like the war was going to be over within weeks of it really beginning. But as Washington sort of dug in, he got pushed back. He's now in like Pennsylvania and New Jersey. And the British troops have now taken over all of downstate New York, so like Long Island, New York City. And then they've also taken over a lot of New Jersey. So it's a lot of victories right off the bat for the British. And it's looking really bleak for the Americans. And morale is dropping quickly. But the troops for the Americans, they find that right across the river, this is the famous crossing of the Delaware. In Christmas of 1776, these Hessian forces that the British have brought over, they've let their guard down, they're partying, they're enjoying their Christmas, and no one really expects in the dead of winter to get attacked. So that's exactly what Washington did, crossed the Delaware, marched a few miles towards Trenton, and surprises the Hessians. They have a quick battle. Washington wins, and thousands of Hessian soldiers end up surrendering, which gives the American troops a massive morale boost. So as news of this battle spreads across into Europe, the main one is France. That's who Benjamin Franklin's actually in France trying to convince the king at the time, King Louis XVI, this new young king of France, to join the war for the Americans. Now, France and England, historically, not the best friends at this time. And France always wants to take a jab at their foe across the English Channel. But they don't really want to get involved in it if they really don't see the point in it. But this victory at Saratoga shows the French that the colonists do actually have a chance of winning. And after this battle, they do set up a formal alliance with the colonies. And France actually declares war on Britain. Spain would eventually join, but not for another year or so.
So, the American forces were kind of on the run. This Battle of Trenton, where Washington is able to capture these troops, gives everyone a huge boost, and it sort of seems like, wait a minute, maybe these plucky Americans have a chance. Kevin, how did the war shake out after these early engagements?
So, responding to the Battle of Trenton, the British want to reestablish themselves here. So, they have General Burgoyne, who's stationed in like Canada and that area, sort of like Quebec and like the eastern part of the province of Ontario. And then you also have Howe, who's towards the south, sort of like New Jersey, New York. Their plan is to follow the Hudson River and cut the northern colonies in half along the Hudson River. So Burgoyne's going to march south, Howe's going to march north. Howe ended up actually changing his plans, so that kind of ruined their plan there. Burgoyne starts marching south. He hits Fort Ticonderoga that we mentioned earlier with Benedict Arnold and the Green Mountain Boys. Captures that and keeps heading south. Howe actually wanted to change things up and sort of go after some personal glory. He instead went south to try and capture the capital, which at the time was not Washington, D.C. It was actually Philadelphia at the time. So at the Battle of Brandywine Creek, Howe delivers a crushing defeat to the colonists, takes control of their capital, but he also leaves Burgoyne exposed in the north, because now Burgoyne doesn't have the support coming from the south. So as Burgoyne heads south, he's met at Saratoga by General Horatio Gates, who's one of the colonial generals. He ends up getting stopped there. A massive battle, actually a series of battles takes place there. British General Henry Clinton, who's also in New York, starts heading north to engage in some of the forts that are south of Saratoga, but it doesn't really work as a diversionary assault. And actually, our friend Benedict Arnold comes back leads some assaults on British redoubts, exposes their camp, and Burgoyne's actually forced to surrender. And this is the first major victory that really tells the world that the American colonists mean business and we can take on this massive army.
So you mentioned Benedict Arnold. In American history, Benedict Arnold is a really important character because he was kind of a very useful general for General Washington and for the Continental Army. But Benedict Arnold is a name synonymous with treason. And so, Nick, can you tell me a little bit about Benedict Arnold and how he became synonymous with betraying his country?
Yeah, well, General Benedict Arnold eventually married a woman named Peggy Shippen, and her family, they were actually British sympathizers. That means they kind of saw things from a British perspective. They believed that the revolution was wrong and that we should stay loyal to the British. And basically, because of this, Benedict Arnold was kind of sent to a different post. He was sent from Philadelphia to defend West Point in New York. But he created a plot there. He had kind of changed his point of view. He had changed from being a patriot to being more of a loyalist. And he plotted to surrender West Point to the British. Eventually, Arnold would flee to New York after his plans were discovered and foiled, but he would continue working and aiding the British as the war went on.
So the war is kind of up in the air. The Americans have had a couple of victories here. The British have had some big victories. New York City has been attacked by the British. It's really sort of a free-for-all, and you're not sure what's going to happen. But George Washington makes a decision during the winter of 1777 into 1778 while at his encampment at Valley Forge, and he's able to take his army, which is a ragtag group of men who are dropping dead from all kinds of diseases and lack of equipment and lack of training, and he turns them into one of the best militaries in the world that is actually able to stand up to the British. We'll start with Kevin. Kevin, can you tell me how this miraculous transformation starts to take place?
Well, part of it happens with some help that does come from Europe. Obviously, after Saratoga and some of these initial victories, European countries start seeing that, hey, we can actually deliver this nice jab right back at the British Empire, especially after the Seven Years' War. So this Prussian officer, Baron von Steuben, comes across the Atlantic and starts helping Washington train his troops. So some of the things that he does is he establishes discipline. So he, you know, sets up a structure for camp. One of the things is, you know, he tells them, you know, as silly as it sounds, you know, don't poop where you sleep or eat, you know, go do that elsewhere. And, you know, there'd be punishments for people who broke camp rules. He also took them from this group that knows more about guerrilla fighting and just taking pot shots at the enemy. Now they're learning how to march in formation, know how to do line drill. They know how to shoot more accurately and quicker. So he's able to turn this ragtag group of colonial fighters that have just been sort of blended together into this army. Now they actually look like a proper military force that can start to take on the British.
So Nick, one of the biggest problems before von Steuben shows up at... So Nick, one of the biggest problems for the camp before Baron von Steuben shows up is that smallpox is spreading like wildfire and men are deserting Washington at Valley Forge. So how was Washington, what did Washington do in order to help his men?
Well, yeah, smallpox definitely was a very big problem. It was a very deadly disease. There was a particularly bad outbreak that year and at his camp. The conditions were really ripe for it to spread, too. You had a lot of men gathered in one area, in as far as their living quarters. Once they constructed them, there would be, in some cases, 8 to 12 men living in a small cabin, essentially. And you can imagine how quickly disease would spread there. And this is at a time where, you know, medical knowledge is still pretty primitive compared to today. So something like that could be extremely deadly. But Washington knew of something. This was actually learned from African slaves, and it was this idea of inoculation. So what they did is it worked almost kind of like how you would use a vaccine that we hear about today. Basically, what would happen is that when soldiers had smallpox, they would have these wounds sort of form on their skin, and there would be pus oozing out of them. It was a really nasty disease. But what they would do is, with soldiers who were already infected with smallpox, they would basically harvest some of the pus that was coming out, as disgusting as it sounds, and then they would cut the skin of a healthy soldier and smear the pus inside. Now, that sounds disgusting, but what it's doing is it's introducing the immune system of the healthy soldier to the disease. So you're able to introduce it in sort of a weaker form. It spreads more slowly that way. And what it allows is the body's immune system to sort of build up, fight it, recognize it, and develop antibodies so that in the future they're immune to it. So Washington took a big gamble here because they weren't certain if it was going to work or not, if it was going to be effective or not. But in this case, it was effective, and Washington was able to hold his army together. He had a lot of things he had to deal with. Smallpox was one of the big ones. He also was dealing with food shortages, the fact that soldiers' enlistments were coming out. But during this difficult time at Valley Forge, Washington's leadership and decision-making helped to keep the army together at a time when it could have easily just sort of disintegrated and ended the revolution.
So the war is becoming kind of a stalemate in the North. No one is really succeeding. Everyone's sort of, they're fighting back and forth, and nothing's really happening. And so the British are sitting back there, and they say, we got to change tactics. We got to do something else. And so the British decide to head south. Now, Kevin, can you explain a little bit about why the British are heading south and how this new tactic is going to change anything?
So part of the reason that they move south is the South is very economically rich. So if you can take the South way, A, you gain the economic benefits, but you also take that away from the colonists who are in rebellion against you. The other part of it is that they perceive, and in a way they're correct in this, the South is more sympathetic to the British cause here. Now, not everyone in the colonies is in favor of revolution. It's usually referred to as the rule of thirds. A third don't care, a third want to break away, and a third want to stay. So their perception is that most of those third that want to stay with the British are in the South, so they think they can march in there and start getting more support from the people. They're going to welcome them there. And they'd already taken Savannah, Georgia. They'll take Charleston soon. So they use Savannah, Georgia as the staging area. So Clinton is the commander-in-chief in the colonies for the British. He's the number one guy. The number two in command is General Cornwallis, who Clinton sends to Savannah, Georgia to start taking over the South. His first major conflict in the South is moving north into Charleston, South Carolina. He lays siege to the city, and after the engagement there, the Americans have their worst surrender of the war. It's over 5,200 men who surrender to General Cornwallis. And also, because Spain and France are now in this war, it's distracting the British troops, so they're also relying more on British sympathizers. As we mentioned, sympathizers, they're more pro-British. And a lot of battles that are happening down in the South, you know, we're talking thousands of people here with Cornwallis. A lot of these battles are 1 to 200 militiamen for the colonies going up against 1 to 200 militiamen who are also colonists, but they're pro-British. So a lot of these are taking place, and those are pretty 50-50. You know, some of the pro-independence militia groups win, but sometimes the pro-British militia groups win as well. And so they have the main force of British troops under Cornwallis, who's marching north, trying to take over as much of the South as possible, but you have these pockets of rebellion taking place as well. The other main battle here with the bulk of this British troops is going to take place in Camden, South Carolina, just north of Camden. Horatio Gates, who was the general at Saratoga, he's going to head south, pick up a bunch of troops. He's going to actually outnumber Cornwallis 2-1, but in one of the most decisive victories of the war for the British, Cornwallis, while suffering hardly any casualties at all, decimates Horatio Gates at this battle and just reestablishes British dominance in the colonies.
The Americans are on the ropes, and they look like they're kind of getting their butt kicked by the British, and this southern strategy for General Cornwallis is working and for the British. So the question, Nick, is how did the Americans rally? How did they turn the tables in the South?
Good question, because we know that they do. So a couple of things happen here. One, a lot of the loyalists that the British had been counting on for support in the South started to kind of change their tune. They were getting attacked, actually, by Native Americans who were seen as allies of the British, and that kind of turned these people against the British. On top of that, they, again, go back to their old tactics, right? They're not winning these head-to-head battles against the British. They're just not going well. So they can go back to their guerrilla warfare tactics. One guy kind of placed in charge of doing that by General Washington is a guy named Nathaniel Greene, the city of Greensboro, named after him today. Greene split his forces, and Cornwallis kind of did the same to go after him. Again, this was kind of a effective tactic of like breaking up this giant British army and kind of dividing it a bit. At a few big battles, the Battle of Guilford Courthouse, the Battle of Kings Mountain in South Carolina and North Carolina, they would fight very well against the British. The British would end up being victorious, but they would lose quite a few soldiers in the process, and Cornwallis was unable to continue his push from the south to the north because his army was now too weak to really continue to do that. So Henry Clinton, the commander of all the British forces, ordered Cornwallis to relocate to Virginia. Cornwallis chooses a peninsula, Yorktown. He believes that it would be easy to resupply because it has a harbor. It has a lot of water around it where they can easily bring the boats up to resupply troops and bring reinforcements in. And so Cornwallis heads to Virginia, gets to Yorktown and fortifies it, and he is going to wait there for his resupply.
Excellent. So the question is, he goes up to Yorktown and things seem like it's going to be okay, but he's asking for help. He's writing basically to get reinforcements and a possible evacuation as the Americans are closing in on him. You have Marquis de Lafayette, who is a French general, and you also have Alexander Hamilton, who is the right-hand man of George Washington, and they're advancing on his position. Now, the Battle of Yorktown takes place because eventually Cornwallis's routes of escape are cut off. How does this happen, and how does the Battle of Yorktown influence the war?
So the way this happens, the two other French people that we'll talk about, Comte de Rochambeau, who's more in charge of ground forces, and then Comte de Grasse, who's in charge of the navy. So first off, in terms of escaping, it's a peninsula, so it's surrounded by water on three sides, so naval presence is going to be huge here. The British navy is under the command of Admiral Thomas Graves, whereas the French navy is under the Comte de Grasse. In the Battle of the Chesapeake, the French ships, they have 24 ships that go into there. They face off against Graves' 19 ships, and the French Navy kicks the British out, dealing heavy damage to their ships. So the British Navy has to move out of the Chesapeake, and they head north towards General Clinton so that they can resupply and make repairs to their ships. The Comte de Rochambeau lands in 1780 in Rhode Island, meets up with Washington, who actually isn't interested in moving south to take on Cornwallis. He wants to take on Clinton. Rochambeau says, it's probably not the best idea. Washington listens. They fake an assault on New York, and they use that cover to actually start heading south in the summer of 1781 towards Yorktown.
So the Battle of Yorktown symbolizes the end of the war. Eventually, Cornwallis is forced to surrender. He sends out one of his subordinates with his sword to surrender it to General Washington. And the British are dealt a huge, huge loss. They were basically outplayed by the Americans, by the French. So how does the war officially end? Because as we know, if you've ever studied the Korean War or anything like that, that an armistice and when you stop fighting, that's just part of the process. How does the war actually end?
Okay, so the war actually ends with the Treaty of Paris. As Brendan said, Yorktown surrounded, cut off. Cornwallis surrenders a huge amount of the British army. News reaches home at the point. People in Britain were getting more and more unhappy with the war and the way it was progressing. They were upset about the cost of the war that was skyrocketing, and they were ready to call it quits. And I tell my students that if they wanted to, the British could have continued the war. They could have raised new armies and kept fighting. They weren't completely and totally destroyed, but it was just that their people were at the point where they didn't want this war anymore. It was just sort of this endless conflict that, you know, hadn't been going well for them. So in Paris, popular place for treaties, is that's where the Seven Years' War would end, with the Treaty of Paris as well. They would meet up. You would have representatives from France, from Britain, from the new United States, and I believe Spain as well. And at this Treaty of Paris, Britain would recognize American independence. So they actually acknowledged at this point that America was an independent country and no longer a colony.
Fantastic. So America has a lot of healing to do after this war. And former British loyalists, people who had supported the crown, in some cases they opted to leave the country. Some went to Canada, others went south towards South America, some went back to England. And you had this situation where the country was in a really volatile space. It was very unknown. The colonies had united with each other in order to fight a common enemy, which was the British Empire. But now they were sort of struggling with what to do next. They really hadn't figured it out. And so, in our next episode, we're going to be discussing the Articles of Confederation and the construction of the American democracy in the years following the American Revolution. For Kevin, for Nick, and for myself, thank you for joining us for Sleeping Through Class. We'll see you next time. Stay safe.